5 years ago, the Boston Globe broke a story of child abuse and cover-up in the Catholic Church. Of course, accusations and denials had appeared before. What the Globe published was a smoking gun, proof that the Boston Archdiocese not only knew about specific allegations against specific priests, but covered them up. Since then, similar stories emerged in other cities and about other institutions that failed to protect the children entrusted to their care. But the scandal hit hardest in Boston and in the Boston Archdiocese. Top church officials were forced to resign. Church property was sold to raise money. Some parish churches were closed as well. The priest at the center of the story, published 5 years ago, was tried, convicted, and then murdered in prison. Later in the program, we'll talk with professional bull riding champion Adriano Moraes. But first, what's changed 5 years after the abuse and cover-up story erupted in Boston? We'll talk with two Globe reporters who covered the story. We'll also hear from someone who filed a suit against one of the abusers and from a priest who saw his congregation through this crisis. And we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions about how the story unfolded or what's happened since, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us talk@npr.org. Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson are part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for the Boston Globe on this story. Michael Paulson is currently religion reporter for that paper. Sasha Pfeiffer is a correspondent for the Globe's investigative unit. They join us now from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Boston. And good to have you both on the program.
Thank you.
Sasha, you were involved with this story from the start. At what point did you grasp the scope of it?
I think it was when our telephones began to ring after we first published our stories and we began to hear from victims. We had no sense of how many people might call us. We had published a tip box that let people call and either talk to us live or leave a recorded message. And hundreds and maybe thousands of people called or emails. Our phones rang almost nonstop for weeks with people who wanted to tell us their tales of abuse.
And we'd heard these stories in much more muted fashion, but we'd heard these stories for years. Why did it explode in 2002?
We had heard, and we in the Globe had been writing about isolated stories of cases of clergy sex abuse or of lawsuits being filed. But the church's argument was always that they were an anomaly. They weren't part of a pattern. And we decided to set out and figure out whether it really was an anomaly or a pattern. And it was clear pretty quickly on that this was a much larger problem than the church had been willing to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm. And the numbers of victims that finally emerged were literally astonishing.
They were. It was incredible. And I think that part of that was due to this being the internet era when our stories could be read everywhere by everyone instantly. Part of it was the shame and stigma of clergy sex abuse lessening and society more willing to talk about sex and sex abuse, and all those things converged, as well as the church files being unsealed when we sent our lawyers to court, which suddenly made it clear that this had been well known to the church.
And Michael Paulson, let me ask you about that aspect of the story, as you're part of this team originally and now covering religion. The Catholic Church stuck to its denials until it couldn't anymore.
Yeah, that's essentially correct. I mean, the church moved accused priests from parish to parish. That was part of the problem. They would sort of acknowledge that they had a problem on their hands, but then they would send the accused priests off for treatment that turned out not to be effective and put them back into positions where they had access to children. So at some level, they knew they had a problem, but they didn't take steps to prevent it from recurring, or at least steps that succeeded in preventing that.
And therefore, finally, when they were forced to admit it, the archbishop at the time, the cardinal, was finally forced to resign.
That's right. In December of 2002, Cardinal Law, who was the archbishop of Boston and had been for nearly 20 years, resigned. He wound up, though, in Rome, where he heads a very prominent basilica for the Vatican.
What's changed in the Boston Archdiocese?
Well, in some ways, a huge amount has changed. I mean, first, as you suggest, the leadership has changed. There's a new cardinal archbishop here named Sean O'Malley. The archdiocese was sent into a tailspin in many ways. Financially, their fundraising dropped by 50%. The number of people going to worship dropped and has not recovered. And they wound up closing 62 parishes out of 357 over the last several years. The archdiocese put into place a number of measures that attempt to do a better job preventing abuse in the future and making sure that if it does occur, that it's identified more quickly and reported to police. So at that level, a lot has changed. at the level of how decisions are made in the archdiocese, in some ways things have remained fairly stable. The power is still concentrated in the church hierarchy as it has been for the last 1,000-plus years. Mm.
Let's get some callers involved in this conversation. If you have questions about how this story unfolded and how it has developed its many ramifications, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Joe. Joe's calling us from Manchester in Massachusetts.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Great show today.
Thank you.
My question to your guest is, the fallout from the church scandals, why weren't Cardinal Law and his underlings prosecuted under either state or federal statutes for essentially repetition crimes against children, ferreting them off to other churches, et cetera? Mm-hmm. Seems to me that that in and of itself for a common person would be enough to put him behind bars for quite a long time. I'll take my... Take your comments off the air. Thanks so much.
Joe, thanks for the call. Sasha, are you the right person to handle this?
Sure. That was a question we received from many, many, many readers. And basically what the prosecutors say is that they simply didn't have what it took to bring prosecutions. They didn't have criminal intent, which basically means that they would have had to approve that a bishop moved a priest with the intent that that priest would abuse a child. That's sort of in a nutshell what we were told. They said they could never prove that.
Mm-hmm. And has that been the case in other parts of the country, to your knowledge? I know you've been covering Boston in particular, but there have been these stories in so many places.
There have. I think so. I mean, we've seen bishops resign. I don't believe we've seen bishops prosecuted. We've seen priests arrested and go to jail, but not bishops charged with criminal intent.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, if I can just jump in here. There were a number of grand juries impaneled around the country, including here in Massachusetts, that issued scathing reports about the conduct of bishops and other church leaders who knew about abuse and failed to stop it from recurring. But there is no place where a prosecutor succeeded in bringing or even attempted to bring a criminal charge against a bishop.
And I'll add that we certainly had prosecutors sort of capitalize on the fact that they were tough on this situation. Our immediate past attorney general, Tom Riley, who just unsuccessfully ran for governor, you know, largely ran on having been tough on the church by sending troopers to the chancery to deliver grand jury subpoenas to Cardinal Law.
Hmm. Sasha, you were talking about that moment when your phone started ringing 5 years ago today after you published the story. The Globe eventually published, I think, some 850 different stories on this topic. What kind of an emotional toll, I wonder, did it take on you?
It was heavy because we heard from hundreds of people, you know, mostly adult men who were often extremely talented and articulate, and they were still coping with something that happened when they were a teenager that had changed their lives in terrible ways. And it was very hard to listen to that and to watch that.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is David. David with us from Kansas, Missouri.
Hello?
Yes, Kansas City, Missouri, I assume that is.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, yes. I was wondering if any of your guests would... I'm actually a plaintiff in a very similar suit that's happening in Kansas City, Missouri, where there are several other plaintiffs with a small group of priests and one bishop. And it seems like that there was a national public outcry for a while, but it seems like the particular diocese in the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese has had the ability to keep our attorneys from having our day in court. Our attorneys estimated that the diocese has spent millions of dollars just in papering our case from reaching the court. And I'm just wondering if you have had any experience about the disparity between diocese and their ability to allow the plaintiffs to have their day in court for similar allegations.
Yeah, Sasha Pfeiffer, we've heard of a diocese that said, oh, this was centrally controlled by the archdiocese. And they said, no, this was each individual parish. There have been a lot of different legal strategies adopted by the church in various places.
There have. There are still a lot of settlements happening. As recently as December, Los Angeles, which I believe is the nation's largest Roman Catholic diocese, settled for about $60 million. But let me have Michael actually speak to this issue.
Michael? I can jump in here. I mean, the church has already spent now $1 billion on the costs of settling and litigating these cases. But there are, as the caller suggests, I'm sorry?
When you say the church, you mean the
I mean nationally, if you add up the amount that all the dioceses that have been sued have spent on abuse cases, it's past $1 billion. And it's still rising. There are still many cases to be litigated in California in particular, which, as you know, is a very large state with mm-hmm. a very large number of allegations. But the caller is correct that dioceses have varied in their response to these lawsuits, and we are still seeing even today in some places very aggressive responses by church lawyers who are attempting to argue that there are First Amendment issues at stake or that these cases happened so long ago that they can no longer be litigated. They are doing everything they can in some places to fight these cases.
And while some dioceses are still settling for large money, often that settlement has the effect of halting the litigation. So any documents that might have come public in the course of litigation, it stops that process.
And David, as one of the plaintiffs in one of these cases, does this sort of action make you feel that they're just trying to find another way to deny that this ever happened?
Neil, it's so frustrating. You know, and I'm an adult now, and this happened many, many years ago, and I feel like I'm functioning well in my life. But it's one of those things that's always present with you, and you go on with your life, but then you hear a case, you know, through the media, you're following the case, and it brings back anger, it brings back frustration, it brings back your faith. And I was an altar boy, Catholic, you know, born and raised, and it's like having a pain in your wisdom tooth that's like always there at the back, and sometimes gets bad and sometimes goes away, and it's very frustrating, and it's really had an effect on my faith in the church and the administration of the church, mm-hmm. and particularly here in Kansas City, because it seems like in some other dioceses that they're being very responsive to it, but in this area, I don't know if it's Bible Belt or more Midwestern, but the church is very powerful, and it's been very frustrating for us to overcome.
David, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a short break. It's been 5 years since public allegations of sexual abuse first shook the Catholic Church. We're looking back on the legacy of that scandal, where we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Michael Paulson and Sasha Pfeiffer, two reporters for the Boston Globe, part of the team that won that newspaper's Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of this story. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The scandal shook the very foundations of the Catholic Church in America. Allegations of sexual abuse by priests had been whispered for years. 5 years ago, the Boston Globe broke it wide open, revealing widespread abuse of children and systematic cover-ups by the church. We're talking with Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson. They're part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the Globe who reported that story. And, of course, we want to hear from you. How has this story affected you? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. In the past segment, we were talking to some degree how the scandal affected the church. It certainly is a story also about victims. Joining us now is Phil Saviano, founder of the Northeast chapter of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. He's with us today also from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Boston. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Good afternoon.
And how did you feel when you saw this story in the newspaper 5 years ago?
Well, I was part of the story because I worked closely with the Globe in the months before the story was broadcast in helping them to arrange interviews with many of the victims and providing background information for them to use in their investigation. So when it finally hit the streets in early January, I was thrilled, and I felt that it was the culmination of what for me had been almost 10 years of activism.
Yeah, you've been trying to publicize this story, and indeed your story, for a long time.
Right.
And with little success?
Well, I had a fair amount of success publishing the details of my own story in terms of the priest in my case, Father David Hawley. What I did not achieve success with was getting news reporters to look beyond the individual priests to see what was going on with the bishops and the cardinals and the fact that there was actually a cover-up and that the bishops were in on the cover-up. I spent a great deal of time trying to convince people to take a closer look at that, but I didn't have much success.
And so, indeed, that story must have been vindication for you.
Well, it was tremendously validating, certainly. But it was also, it was very, very important for other survivors. And it gave them an opportunity to say, finally, someone is taking this issue seriously. And I think that's one of the reasons why Sasha and the rest of the Spotlight team heard from so many victims calling because suddenly they felt, well, okay, now's the time. The Globe is taking a serious look at this. This is the time to speak out.
And as you've heard this reverberate around the country these past 5 years, that seems to be a fundamental change in public perception of what happened.
Well, it's true. You know, in many ways, the secrecy has been shattered, and the public is not only more aware of what was going on behind the scenes, but they're more likely to deal with it properly. For example, I think a big change nowadays is that if a child is being molested or being approached by a priest, the kid is much more likely to tell his parents. And the parents are much more likely to not only believe the child, but also report the incident to the police as opposed to going to the bishops. And in that sense, that's a major change. You know, abuse thrives in secrecy, and the way to stop abuse from happening is for people to talk about it. And if nothing else, people are certainly talking about it.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Elizabeth. Elizabeth joining us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Kind of an emotional issue, but my husband was abused as a child, and all of the information that's come out has allowed him to start dealing with his abuse, but it's also really torn our family up, and I wonder how the church expects to deal with not just these survivors of abuse, but their families. How do they expect their families to worship, even if they want to, when a spouse was so badly abused, they don't want to see another priest for the rest of their lives? It's just the foundation of families involved in this issue has been shaken, you know, I think far more than the church.
Mm-hmm. I'm Michael Paulson. I wonder if you could give us an answer to that.
Sure. I think a lot of dioceses, including the Archdiocese of Boston, are aware of this issue and have set up these offices that attempt to reach out to victims and their families. And the Archdiocese of Boston has begun attempting to reconcile those victims who are interested in that with the sort of the church as a center of worship. But for a lot of victims who were so profoundly injured at the start of their faith lives by the most important person in their faith institution, the priest, it's just not possible. I mean, there are a lot of victims who just can't walk back into the physical structure of a Catholic church, and that's going to remain a lifelong challenge both for the victims and for the church that for many people I don't think will ever be resolved, but for some it has been.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Phil Saviano, as someone who's in a not totally unanalogous position from Elizabeth and her family, I wonder, have you been able to get past this? Do you go to church?
No, I'm a very happy and proud agnostic these days. I don't go to church. But I will say to someone like our caller that there are many other organized religions that she can choose from. The Episcopalian Church does not seem to have this problem, and it's set up in many ways similar to the Catholic Church. Of course, they do allow their clergy to marry, which is a big difference. But for people who don't feel comfortable in a Catholic church but still want to have some sort of faith life in an organization, there are many other choices to be made.
Elizabeth, thank you very much for the call. I know it wasn't easy. Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Here's an email we got from Kevin, sort of along these lines. As a former Catholic, a problem I had was due to having three small children. I felt I could not change religions without facing questions from the children about, well, why are we now in a different religion? I didn't want to tell them the reason we changed religions because it was because hundreds of priests sexually molested thousands of children. So we just stopped going to church. And have your guests seen this problem in others? And I guess, Sasha Pfeiffer, is this something you've experienced?
Yes, I think this is one of the most difficult and enduring problems, which is, you know, how do you reconcile if you are a Catholic who is very troubled by what happened, how do you reconcile what can be your anger towards the Vatican, sort of the institutional church, towards what is often your love for your local parish and your local parish priest? And that's a really difficult thing to resolve. And I think many people are still wrestling with it.
Let's go to Emily. Emily calling us from South Bend in Indiana.
Hi. I'm a student at Notre Dame, and this is a big issue here all the time. And I was wondering whether this issue is unique to the United States or to North America, or it's a problem for clergy other places in Western Europe and Latin America. And if it is unique to the United States, both the sex abuse and the secrecy, why is that the case?
Michael Paulson, I know that this has been a big issue in, among other places, Ireland.
Yeah, I was just going to mention Ireland. It's certainly not unique to the United States. What remains unknown is whether the scale is the same elsewhere, but there doesn't appear to be any reason to believe that the United States is in some way special. There are accusations of clergy sexual abuse all over the world. There are various parts of the world where this subject is still taboo, is not taken seriously by criminal authorities, and is much more difficult to discuss in civil society, so you hear less about it. But there have been accusations all over, and I think it's too early to attempt to judge whether the statistics are even across the world or even within the United States.
The other reason is that in the United States we have a different legal system. We have the civil system, which allows people to file a suit and get access to their records. That system does not exist in many other countries.
Hmm. Our understanding, Neil, is also that particularly in South America, where the Catholic, the influence of the Catholic Church is huge, and there's still very much a culture of deference, that the problem is particularly bad.
Mm-hmm. And this is a follow-up question, I guess partly answered. Linda in Mount Shasta, California, can you tell us if you know this is a problem endemic to the Catholic Church, or statistically is the incidence of priest-minister abuse similar in other religions and, for that matter, in the population at large? And again, Michael Paulson, I think what you were saying is we don't have enough data.
Yeah, although we did attempt to look at that. I mean, certainly there is abuse in all organizations in which adults have unrestricted access to children. So you see this in scouting organizations, in schools, in families, and in churches. However, we have not seen abuse at the same statistical level in other religious denominations. In the Archdiocese of Boston, according to the Archdiocese's own figures, 7% of archdiocesan priests were accused of abusing a minor over the second half of the 20th century. We have not seen accusations at that level elsewhere.
Emily, I hope that answers your question, at least in part.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call. Let's go now to Eve, and Eve is with us from Wayne, New Jersey.
Hi. My comment is I think this is a good thing. I think I'm a lector. I'm a devout Catholic. I'm a lector in church. And I've been following some of the things that have been going on, and I think it's a good thing. The cleanup is what we need. The church has to take responsibility for making priests be the kind of people that want to be priests and really finding out who really is going to carry on and be a soldier for Christ. But otherwise, this has happened before. I mean, during the medieval times, people were tortured, women, men. They were all hanged or burned. And so the human nature inside religion is still there. It isn't only something that's divine. We make up the religion. You know, Mother Teresa died, you know, and she was asked what was wrong with the Catholic Church, and she said, you and I. It's not an entity beside ourselves. We are the entity. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I'm sure what Eve meant is a good thing that this story was uncovered, not that it happened in the first place. And I wonder, do you feel that way, Phil Saviano?
What, that it's a good thing that it was uncovered?
Well, that it has also fundamentally changed things in the church, that the that this has been an important fundamental change.
Well, I think it's certainly changed things in society. I'm not convinced that it's changed things in the church. I mean, I can give you an example. Just in the last month, I can cite two examples. There was a case of a priest from Washington State who had been caught with naked photos of young boys on his computer. He was removed from his parish, transferred to a job in a St. Louis parish with a parochial school. But none of the parishioners in St. Louis were told about the reasons for the priest's transfer there. Another case in Fresno, a civil trial was held. A priest was accused of molesting a boy, was found guilty in the trial, but his bishop is standing by the priest saying, I believe the priest is innocent, and he will stay in active parish ministry, which is in direct contrast to what the requirements are through the Dallas Charter. So I'm not convinced that things have changed all that much. And the other thing is certainly the celibacy requirement has not changed. Mm-hmm. And I think that people who have much more knowledge about this than I do, people like psychologist Richard Sipe, who has studied this for decades, will tell you that in many cases celibacy is a sham. And many priests and bishops have a hard time adhering to those requirements. What happens then is you have a priest who may be having a relationship, an adult relationship, which in many ways is natural and healthy, but it's a secret and it's condemned by the Vatican. And it creates an organization that's layered in many layers of secrecy, and that's a great environment for somebody like a child molester to find a hiding place.
Before we let you go, Phil, you've been doing this for quite a while now. What's next for you?
Well, I'm running the SNAP website. In fact, I encourage your listeners to take a look at it. It's at snapnetwork.org. To observe the anniversary, I've posted a number of TV news broadcasts from January of 2002. I'll continue running the website, and I run websites for other companies as well. And I'm no longer leading support groups, but clearly I'm still very involved in this issue.
Appreciate your time today. Phil Salviano is founder of the Northeast Chapter of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, joining us today from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Boston. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Father Paul O'Brien arrived at St. Patrick's Parish in Lawrence, Massachusetts, a year before the scandal broke today. He joins us by phone from the parish just outside Boston to tell us how he's helped guide his parishioners through the last 5 years. Father O'Brien, appreciate your being with us today.
Thank you.
And I wonder, I assume this had the same enormous impact in your congregation as it did everywhere else.
It did, obviously, particularly because we're a congregation of the Archdiocese of Boston. We all know now very clearly that very few people in the church had any kind of extensive knowledge of child sexual abuse by priests. We were aware from the Porter case in the early 90s about the existence of child sexual abuse by priests, but nothing commonly about the scale of it. That's, you know, lay people, priests, sisters, everybody.
At the parish level, you're talking
about. At the parish level. And even in the, I worked for the administration of the church before I worked in my present parish. Even within the institutional church, it's not as if there were a large number of people handling this reality. And so you could be quite involved in the leadership of the institutional church and have really very little knowledge of it, or really no knowledge of it.
And I wonder, as anger about this story spread, were you and your parishioners angry at the church for the cover-up, at the reporters for breaking the story, at church leadership?
All of the above. I think the biggest thing in the first year was shock after shock after shock. There were obviously plenty of people who were angry in all different directions, and disappointed, and shaken, all different kinds of reactions. But I think it was because the revelations came out one after another, shock was the predominant reaction.
Mm-hmm. And how has the scandal directly affected your parish? Has financial contributions gone down?
Actually, because we're an inner-city parish, I think there seemed to have been a trend that urban parishioners tended to deal with the reality a little bit more directly and probably processed it a little bit more quickly than an awful lot of suburban parishes. So we didn't really see any sort of precipitous drop financially or any sort of precipitous drop in parishioners' involvement in the life of the church. And also we were very actively trying to process with everybody what was going on, talking about what was going on, just working through it together. So I think the biggest impact has been actually positive, that like all of the parishes and schools and hospitals of the Archdiocese, there now is a very comprehensive child sexual abuse prevention effort in the Archdiocese. One of the things that was learned by all of us in this crisis was it is very difficult, and it remains very difficult, to identify people who are child sexual abusers. But what you can do is create an environment in which people know what the behavior patterns of abusers are so that they can really watch out for them. So you may know that all of the volunteers in my parish, there are more than 1,000 volunteers. Every volunteer in every institution of our archdiocese now has to go through a very basic but very substantive training program about the signs of child sexual abuse. So the way that we watch one another in our community now is radically different from the way we watched one another 5 years ago, because we're trained in this.
Father O'Brien, stay with us. We have to take a short break. Also, we're asking Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson of the Boston Globe to stay with us. And more of your calls after we come back from a short break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're looking at the Catholic Church 5 years after it was rocked by scandal, allegations of sex abuse by priests, and a wide-ranging cover-up. The Boston Globe broke the story, and the ripple effects continue today. Today, a Kentucky judge allowed a sex abuse lawsuit against the Vatican to go forward. And the scandal prompted the Catholic Church to revise its policy on clergy sex abuse. You can find out more about the new rules and their effects thus far at npr.org. We're talking today with reporters from the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the Boston Globe that first reported the story, Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson, as well as with Father Paul O'Brien, priest of St. Patrick's Parish in Lawrence, Massachusetts, who ministered his church through the scandal. We'd like to hear from you as well. If you have questions about how this story broke and about its effects, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk at npr.org. And Michael Paulson, before the break, Father O'Brien was talking about how the scandal has changed the way he operates in his parish. Is that what you see as you report on religion now for the Boston Globe?
Certainly throughout the Archdiocese of Boston, all parishes are required to be running criminal background checks on everyone they hire and everyone who is working in the parishes, even on a volunteer basis. There are training programs for all adults who are working in parishes to help them spot signs that a child might be abused. And there are educational programs for kids that are supposed to help them understand what kind of touching is inappropriate and what to do if somebody touches them inappropriately. Also, all clergy, including Father O'Brien, are now required to report suspected abuse to state authorities. So, yes, that has taken place throughout the Archdiocese of Boston and in many dioceses throughout the country.
I wonder, Father O'Brien, when you have to institute measures like that, the trust that existed for so long, the trust that was such an important part of the Catholic Church you grew up in, is that gone forever?
It is, in the way it was blind trust, sure. And that's not just for priests. It's for the teachers in my school. It's for all of our volunteers. And so whatever loss there is in appropriate intimacy with young people for, you know, healthy adult leaders, it's unfortunate that we've lost that. It is, however, I think, a small price to pay for really taking steps ahead to prevent the likelihood that unhealthy people would ever abuse kids. So, yeah, I'm sure that we really have lost a comfort level, and I think it's probably more the comfort level of adults with kids rather than kids with adults. But that's reality in response to a terrible, terrible thing that had existed for far too long.
Here's an email we got from Sherry in Portland, Oregon, who notes that she's proud to be a Catholic. She asks, I would like to hear the guests expand on what the church had actually done, i.e. to pay for counseling for the victims when known and to send priests to counseling, which she notes was the in thing to do in the 1950s and 1960s. Was the church, Sasha Pfeiffer, acting in good faith?
Well, it was sending some priests to facilities that were supposedly counseling them on sex abuse. Our research found that they were very ineffective. In some ways, it was R&R. Often you still saw recidivism rates that were high. So I think it was largely ineffective.
The conclusion that a lot of people came to was that the church appeared to be caring a great deal more for the priests who were involved in these stories than for the victims.
I think that's what was extremely angering to so many readers, is that once the court records were unsealed and we began to report on what had been in the church file cabinets, it was clear that there was huge sympathy on the part of the church hierarchy for priests. You know, John Gagan was one of the most notorious priests in the Boston Archdiocese, and there were these sort of Dear Jack letters. You know, we're sorry for your difficulties. We're sorry for the hard things you're going through. It was total sympathy towards the priest, almost no mention of victims. We saw that again and again and again.
And I wonder what it was like for you. Jack Gagan was later tried and convicted and, as we noted earlier, murdered in prison.
He was. It was a very sad outcome. I mean, I think his murder was as shocking as anything else that happened over the course of this crisis.
Hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Joanna. Joanna with us from Central Iowa.
Yes. Hello.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air, please.
Yes, okay. I am certainly, sympathetic to the victims of all of this, definitely. And from what Father O'Brien said, it looks like there's been a lot of steps taken. I am wondering, however, we are such a suit society, sue. How many of these priests have been exonerated and put through a lot that really was not, that they shouldn't have had to go through, or maybe they did, but how many of these are valid, and how many of these do you find that are really not valid, and there's people out there that are just finding an area that they can probably get some sympathy in and sue?
Michael Paulson?
I don't have an easy statistic for you on that, but the number of false accusations thus far has been very low. There have been a handful of instances here in the Archdiocese of Boston in which cases have been investigated and then dropped. Priests have been restored to duty, but it's a small minority of the overall number of accusations, and in some cases it's because of a lack of evidence rather than a kind of full-fledged criminal trial. Most of these accusations, both in Boston and nationally, took place so long ago that there are no criminal trials.
And I think this is a case where lawsuits can be a very good thing, because if it weren't for a lawyer in Boston named Mitch Garabedian, who began filing a lot of lawsuits against the Boston Archdiocese, we wouldn't have gotten the files we did, because those lawsuits became the vehicle to get access to those files through the courts.
Father O'Brien, you were trying to get in?
I was going to say, there's what Michael is saying is correct, that I believe there are plenty of cases from the distant past that there just is not an easy way to resolve guilt or innocence. If somebody made a false accusation against me today, I have access to the legal system to deal with that today. There would be an investigation today. It can be processed now, but if this were 30 years ago, I think there are cases in which people are just floating where there isn't a determination of guilt or innocence.
Joanna, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And let me ask you finally, as we look 5 years back, 5 years from now, Michael Paulson, do you think that there's going to be another, it's hard to imagine anything as shocking as what happened in those first few months after you guys started reporting, but is this a story that's going to continue to be alive and continue to be developing, do you think?
Well, certainly the repercussions of this crisis are going to be felt by the church for decades, and we'll still be following the implications for the church's membership, for its finances, for its practices. There is no indication that the level of abuse is continuing at the same rate, and there's a debate about whether that's simply because it takes often victims many years to report allegations or whether the abuse rate has actually gone down. But most of the allegations concern incidents that took place some years ago. The number of accusations against more recently ordained priests is at the moment low. So I guess everyone would hope that we won't be seeing a recurrence of the allegations in these same kind of numbers.
Sasha Pfeiffer, what lesson do you draw from the last 5 years?
When people have asked me that question, I've said that it reminded me of the importance of questioning an authority, and I still believe that, because people didn't question the church throughout the 50s and the 60s, and this crisis was the result of that.
Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson of the Boston Globe, thank you both for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our thanks also to Father Paul O'Brien, the priest of St. Patrick's Parish in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Appreciate your joining us today.
You're welcome.
And when we come back after a break, we'll continue with the story of a bull rider from Brazil.